SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Friday, race fans. Sirius 219 XM 201 Sports Zone 964. If you're listening to Sirius XM online and at our website too, stevebeck.com. And looking forward to tomorrow night. Looking forward to a busy full weekend of action. All kinds of things kind of happening today and then into Saturday and Sunday. Big day right here in beautiful Greenwich. It's the day. The weekend you wait for all year. It's Whipple City Days. That's right. You hear me talk about it every year. It's like a Founders Day thing. Jeb Whipple. He made plows. He made snow plows and plows for farms. Early 19th century. And this was called Whipple. This town has been called like four different things. Whipple City. Battenville, on the Battenkill River, then Union Village, because it raised a Union Army contingent, one of the first, to put together a regiment. So it was Union Village, and then ultimately Greenwich, as opposed to Greenwich, and no one's ever explained why that is. Why we pronounce it Greenwich instead of Greenwich. But it's a pretty adorable little town, and Whipple City Days, awfully fun. Awfully fun here. There's another parade, of course, right in the shadow. We're still aglow and abuzz from the Memorial Day parade. it's kind of cool, and everybody goes down to the village square, and you there's music, and there's Moby Dick fish fry, or as we say around here, the lutesse of fish fry. Kind of fun. So, and then tomorrow though, I got my dad 90th birthday, 90 years old, and my dad still works. My dad works. He's still building. They're building CVSs and Cumberland Farms all over the place. 90 years old. And the guy he's worked with for most of his life is 94. It's unbelievable. It's good, though. It's good to keep him active and, you know, mentally sharp. So we'll be with my father tomorrow in Hartford and a number of family such as it is. We don't have a lot, but we're all getting together, kind of a combination Father's Day and 90th birthday. And then Sunday, Father's Day for everybody, and good day to go to the racetrack. Traditional in a lot of places. Arlington in particular. Arlington, I think at one time, wasn't it way back when? Was it opening weekend at one time in Chicago? I think it was, and it was always a big Father's Day has always been a big deal at Arlington. Also is going to be a force out. We'll talk about it with Hammer. We're going to look at that pick six sequence, which includes the Affirmed on Sunday at Santa Anita. They're going to force out a million and a half right now on the jackpot. They're going to force that out, and then they'll force it out again next weekend, closing day, but you know, to get the big pot out. And Father's Day, a good day for it, and it's actually a good sequence. So that'll be part of the discussion today. And then, of course, Saturday night at Churchill. We'll talk to Marty McGee to start hour two. And we'll go through the Foster. Tina, I'm sorry if I'm distracted. Tina's peppering me here with texts. We've got a thing being delivered. It's unbelievable. Holy cow. All right. I'll try to figure that out at the first break. I'll tell you. What am I supposed to do here, Tina? What do you want me to do? They're on their way. Got it. Okay. Thank you. Wow. do you remember who I know I've mentioned this before. Do you remember the famous moment on Tony Kornheiser's show with the cat who I forget who the guest was with there's a guest on the show. Tony's talking to him and there's a knock on the door. They're delivering furniture or a couch and it became a running gag about the Castro convertibles. That was the best. Oh, too funny. Yesterday we were looking forward to the racing, the late afternoon racing at Belmont. We had two horses in, as I mentioned, and we ended up scratching Minute Mouse because the two of the races came off the turf, two stayed on, and the maiden state bred group came off in the nightcap, and Gary really wants to keep her on the turf. As a 2-year old, she's had terrible weather whenever she seems to enter. It's unbelievable. And she ran a couple of times off the turf, and it's just doesn't seem like it's going to be her thing. So that left us with Carlisle Bell in the fifth, and just a huge thrill to have her win the way she did. Benji Hernandez with a tremendous ride. You know, and sprinting, it's been tough for her just because they have a tendency to run away and she's left with too much to do. I give Benji tremendous credit because they went fast up front, but he started to move, you know, after letting her settle. He started to move after a quarter and getting toward the turn, I said, she's putting in a run here. And when she got to the top of the stretch, I thought, wow, I mean, she's going to be no worse than second. And then in the late strides, she caught that 1-2 favorite of Mike Stidham's and got by and you know, head and shoulders. I gotta say, particular enjoyment having bred her. She's such a hard trier, and she's seemingly, you know, at her best now at five. I mean, she had a couple of little delays getting to the races, but you know, that's her second win, and she ran a career best. She ran a career best fig. She's going to get a big number on Thoroughgraph because she was way wide. Hernandez went right around, and it's, you know, I wish I was there. Obviously, I do want to be there for one of her wins. Hopefully, one comes at Saratoga. But she put herself. She actually has earned herself a chance back against state bred. This was open claiming 40 non-winners of two. And with that fig, actually, she kind of shoulders herself up into state bred company again, allowance company. So we'll look forward to Saratoga and we're going to have a nice, it's going to be a fun summer. We're looking to buy one New York bred today. The OBS sale concludes and we'll have We've got four. I got a short list, a short list, as it were, of about three or four. So two fillies and two colts. Actually, really, two fillies and one colt are the prime candidates. And a couple of them are going to go through while we're on the air this morning, I think. And we'll keep an eye on that. We won't do the same thing. We had fun on Wednesday, but we're going to let Tom Ventura handle it for us this morning. So hope to have another one. And, of course, the data link that we bought on on Wednesday, headed down to Chuck Simon. So two-year-olds for this year. And the other three from last year that are now three-year-olds doing okay. Mouse and Kid Chocolate, who's recovering from the throat surgery. So we're in position to have our best year ever. And we got the mayor down in Philadelphia, Parks, Just Enough Hope, with Mike Farrow as well. So really, thanks to everybody for the kind words and congratulations. It really, really fun. Great job by Gary and Paul Barone and everybody at the barn. And very, always satisfying. And it, there's nothing like the aftermath of a win. You just, I scared Tina though. I scared because when I realized that she had a real chance, I'm a pretty good rooter. I didn't go to the whip. I didn't go to the program. You know, no, I didn't do that. But I did do some. I did do some exhorting. Let's say that. Speaking of the sale, let's give you a couple of results from yesterday. The session topper was a Gosapper Philly, and of course we talked Gosapper a little came up with Sid the other day. This was a Len Reggio bred. Out of the nice Polanco City, $445,000 to Backstretch Farms. The top colt, $260,000. Nick Hines. In fact, Nick has been active. Nick's bought a handful. And this was a Great R colt that came very shortly after the Gosapper Philly. Bred by Woods Edge, consigned by Costanza Sales. Nick Demerick had the Gosapper. And today, the apparent, at least the expectation, is that the Into Mischief Philly, Hip 748, maybe we'll keep an eye on it, and who had a brilliant quarter. She went 20-4, and Top Line has this one, Hip 748, expected to be the sale topper later. This is the sister, full sister, to Rowayton. And, of course, Rowayton with that nice allowance win at Belmont the other day. Also the family of Miss Mischief, second dam Kid Magic, the Lemon Drop Kid that got Miss Mischief. This makes sense. It's got a nice page and had the great work. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. That'll be fairly early, actually, because the session starts, this final session at OBS starts at 10 o'clock. And I think they start at 7:20-something. So this horse should go in the first 35, 40 minutes. So we'll keep an eye on that for you. All right. The first seller today, Hip 721, A Kitten's Joy, Eddie Woods. We'll get started. So it's about 20 plus hips in. All right. And actually, we got an eye on something in that range as well. So last of the two-year-old in training sale sellers. Let's talk a little bit as we go to the break. Perfect timing. Thanks, Joe. The first voice, the next voice you hear on the guest front, Dave Hill is going to join us, one of our favorite writers, big contributor to ABR, but Dave writes for all kinds of periodicals and online locales, including the piece last week that, if you haven't seen it, at The Ringer, Requiem for a Sports Better. Just terrific. Absolutely terrific. And in fact, I've been talking to Maury Wolf, and I asked Maury, I said, did you see Dave Hill's? I told him Dave was going to be on. I said, did you see Dave Hill's piece? He said, yeah. He said, everybody, all the sports bettors have passed it around. What the topic is concern among the professional sports gamblers that the new gambling landscape, particularly with the European bookmaking operations making deals and operating the sports books for, you know, various, you know, the various outlets that are going to be accepting wagers, they're shutting out the sharp players. The sharpies are and all the top players are being limited. Their access is being, you know, determined and limited. And that's not right. That's not the way it's supposed to be. So Dave wrote about it, and nobody enjoys the internecine or the clandestine world more than Dave Hill. And we also are going to get an update on his book, The Vapors. Looking forward to that. And, of course, the famed Hot Springs nightclub denizen. So, Dave Hill to kick things off this morning. And Nick Tamaro, of course, we'll talk to Nick, get his Belmont recap because he ended up second in the betting challenge. Another nice score for Nick. Marty McGee ahead of Foster Knight, and it was 4 years ago tonight, right now, today, that Foster Knight, I talked about, was it yesterday or Wednesday, about American Pharoah. Really special night at Churchill. We'll check in with Hammer, Scully and or DeRosa, not sure both, and as promised, we're going to start the week and end the week with a lot of luck. Nick Luck. Ask It preview. And I just heard from Ron Anderson before I went on the air. Ron says, you know, the weather going to be very helpful for the early on, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday particularly. It's going to be nice and dry and conditions that could favor the American Ask It performers. Back after this, Dave Hill joins us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up at ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use Express Fund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
With 35 years at the forefront of sports technology, Stats provides next-generation sports content for basketball, baseball, football, soccer. And now, Stats is turning its sights to horse racing. Racelens is the most in-depth product on the market. With innovative analytics powered by data from Echobase, it will change the way you follow horse racing. Stats Racelens, bringing clarity to handicapping. Learn more at stats.com/racelens.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
The faces all around me, they don't smile, they just crack. Waiting for our ship to come, but our ship's not coming back. We're doing time like pennies in a jar.
We're back at the races 20 minutes into weekend preview, but we will delay the preview conversation about racing on the weekend. And there's plenty of interesting things beside Churchill, too. It turns out that Maximum Security is going to run Sunday. So those of you in Jersey, you want to see the, how do we describe the, I guess you could say the DQ'd winner of the Derby. You could say the first horse across the wire in the Derby, however you want to term it. But Maximum Security going to go in that Pegasus on Sunday, prepping for the Haskell. So, and we're looking forward to going down to Monmouth for Haskell week. Can easily tie Monmouth conversation into our first discussion, even without any race previewing, because Dave Hill, who is just such a talent, and his writing is so much fun. He's got an inquisitive mind. He loves the rapscallion and roustabout life, and he seeks out those topics with gusto. And he joins us now. Dave, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. You know, back in the day, they called it the sporting life, I think.
Yes, very perfect. Perfect. I love it. Well, the first order of business, because, you know, now we're getting impatient. There's some toe tapping going on here. The Vapors. How close are we?
We've got a tentative release date, and we're going to be on the spring 2020 list. So it's coming out. It'll be spring of 2020.
Spring of 2020.
Yeah.
And I would say that, you know, an ideal kickoff might be at Oaklawn, Arkansas Derby week.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Let's hope we can get the stars to line up. I'm
all right.
It's done. It's been a long time coming.
Well, looking forward to it. And you tackle topics and you really dive into them. And this sports betting piece at the Ringer last week, and you know, obviously we were deep into Belmont preparation and wrapping up the classic season, mm-hmm. but this got an immediate wave, and because of your association with racing topics, and because of just the, you know, the interest on the sports betting front and a lot of crossover, it's been really heralded. And in fact, Maury Wolf, just yesterday, I asked Maury, Dave Hill's going to be on. I said, did you see his piece? And he said, oh my God, everybody saw it. He said, I've been sending it around. So, this hit home, and it's a disconcerting topic.
Well, I'm glad that people are reading it. I was a little bit nervous because it ran long, you know, it's a longer piece. But that's what happens when, I mean, I worked on it since February, since the Super Bowl. I started, you know, hanging around with Spanky and working on the story. And anytime you work on a story for that long, you know, I just compiled so much, you know, so many stories and so much research, and I just wanted to put it all in there. After a while, I was like, man, I'm kind of writing a book here. but I'm so grateful that my editors at The Ringer allowed me that much space to write it. I worried that it might cut some of the audience off, but it seems like it hasn't. It seems like people were sticking with it and reading the whole thing.
No doubt. And before we dive into some of the key elements and also some of the, I would say, you know, tangential racing portion that, you know, some key learnings that could tie into horseplay. What was the motivation for this? How did you even sort of wade into the topic?
Well, this started out sort of like an assignment from an editor who was curious about sports betting in New Jersey. And, you know, this idea came earlier this year. So we were, you know, not even 6 months into legalized bookmaking in New Jersey. And the Super Bowl was coming up. So there was some interest in doing some sort of a story about the state of things there, and people were wondering if I was able to get in touch with maybe a bookie or a big sports player or whatever, and just sort of find out, you know, how this has all impacted their world. So I had reached out to Spanky to see if I could hang out with him during the Super Bowl, and I was just going to write a story about the, you know, watching the Super Bowl in Atlantic City. And he said, I'm not going to watch the Super Bowl. I don't even think I'm going to bet it. So that didn't go anywhere. But he said, hey, I want to pitch you a different idea. So that's kind of how the story came about.
Well, and you mentioned Spanky, and there's some other, you know, very high profile sports bettors and sports betting machinery players involved in this story. Very familiar to horse playing community, Alan Denkinson, and some of the sportsbook personalities from Vegas and from Jersey. And you know, you talk about the, you know, the overall, you know, system that's evolving and developing in the United States, this landscape, which is exactly a year old. It was just the, what, last week that they celebrated at Monmouth, the 1 year anniversary of the opening of the sports book. But at the same time, it's really a cautionary conversation, because those European outlets are, you know, basically barring the best players is the essential element of, you know, the whole story.
Yeah, that's right. It's and it's something I didn't just hear from Spanky. I mean, I really started to believe this was true after I heard it from literally every sports bettor I talked to. And this is like from, you know, the sharpest pros down to, you know, just sort of, you know, recreational players that, you know, play, recreational players that play more than just sides and totals, you know. So what I started to hear over and over again was that certain companies were very aggressive about limiting what people can bet, and in some cases not letting them bet at all in Nevada. In New Jersey, there's a law that was passed because of card counters, blackjack card counters in New Jersey, that the that in that state you can't bar somebody from making a bet. You can, however, limit their action to essentially nothing. So it's effectively the same as barring them. But I heard it over and over again, the same story, and I started to realize there was, where there's smoke, there's probably fire. So I dug in deeper. I went to this conference, and an industry conference in New Jersey, and I talked to people on both sides of the desk, you know, bookmakers and bettors. And, you know, it's true that these, it seems true to me that these, that some of these European companies have a much different model about how they expect to make money as bookmakers than the way that I think American companies that grew up in Nevada, or you know, or the way the traditional bookmaker street, kind of street or gray market or black market bookmaker in America has made money, which is to deal 11 to 10, if you know what I mean.
Yes, and what the tale tells is really, you know, how players as they go up the ladder. And in fact, one note that I made was that seven categories that you got from the research firm: casual dabblers, status seekers, super fans, action chasers, would be pros, high rollers, and sharps. And you know, I hinted at, you know, the parallels to horseplay, and undoubtedly, you know, the same kind of strata exists on our landscape, but you know, the obvious concern here is that after having to jump through all kinds of hoops, Dave, the professional sports gambler in this country, and that included offshore situations and dealing with government, you know, policing that didn't understand the mechanics of, you know, what the difference was between a bettor and a bookmaker. And, you know, I remember those, you know, all the seizures and all the things that, you know, went on, you know, 10, 15 years ago. You know, here's what looks like a bonanza for I suppose more for casual players, and really a specter for the serious player.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that what I expected to find, I expected that, you know, pro sports players would be super excited about the expansion of opportunities in New Jersey and in other states. And instead, they're very nervous about it. I mean, there are some people who feel like this is ultimately a, you know, I think across the board, everybody thinks ultimately it's a good thing that this is, that PAPSA was overturned, and that we're going to see sports betting, you know, kind of come into the light and across the country be regulated, legalized and regulated. I think there's I think everybody I talked to was happy about that and optimistic that this is going to be better than having to bet offshore where there's no regulation, where, you know, your bets could just be, your winning bets can be denied, you know, your losing bets get traded, right, and your winning bets. They're happy to see that there'll be an expansion of that, but they're nervous about certain companies, and particularly European-based companies, because, and just to be explicit about it, I mean, what I saw and what I think people talked a lot about was that European companies will profile their players fairly aggressively, and every bookmaker profiles their players, but that European companies would aggressively profile players, and if you're a player who can beat the opening line, meaning you get your bet in at a line that's more favorable to what you bet than what the line closed at, if you can do that regularly enough, your bets will be severely limited. And this isn't just for big players like Spanky who try to bet in the five figures. I mean, I heard from a guy who was a big Yankees fan and wanted to bet $100 on the Yankees on opening day. So he made the bet well in advance. And by making the bet in advance, he got a much better number than what the number was when the game went off. And he was immediately limited where he could no longer bet more than like $30. You know, he kind of got marked as a sharp just because he beat the line on one baseball side. So, you know, it's just that it's a practice that I think bookmakers have always done, right? That they've always sort of they've always made assessments of their players, tried to figure out who's sharp, and maybe limit the sharps action, or talk, you know, figure out how they can, you know, play the sharps where they don't end up on the wrong side of them. But certain companies are so aggressive about this, and not only that, they use algorithms to do it, right? They have computer programs to assess who's sharp or who's not, or what players they should limit, and those algorithms come up with lots of false positives. And they are very quick. They're sort of trigger happy about taking players and putting them into these categories. And it definitely means that it definitely is sort of an existential threat to anybody that makes their living betting on sports. But even those people who recreationally play sports and win over time, it's going to really cut into what they potentially could win because their bets will be so limited. And so I just think it's a bad. It's just something that I think. Grates on most of us that it doesn't feel like fair play. And for me as a gambler and somebody who's really interested in gambling, it just seems like it violates the, I don't want to use the word gentlemanly, but you know, it violates sort of the contract that we have as gamblers, where if you offer a bet and I take it, then we have a bet and we're both going to honor that. You know, the idea of a bookmaker is that the bookmaker gets to deal 11 to 10 to those of us that are taking the bet, and that's the advantage they get. The advantage we get is that we get to pick which bet we want to take. And that's always been the arrangement since the beginning of time between bettors and bookmakers. But what we have now is bookmakers who both want that 11 to 10 advantage, but they also want to be able to only take bets from people that they think are suckers. And they also want to take, and this I think is a key point, they also get the benefit from the information that sharp or smart bettors have by allowing those sharps to ask for the bet and then to deny them, right? Which means they get the information of what the sharp player was going to bet for free, and they get to adjust their lines accordingly. And I think that's completely unfair and really, you know, upsets the apple cart with how this whole market works. Because a sharp player's bets are information, and that information has real monetary value both to the sharp and the bookmaker. It seems very unfair that a bookmaker gets to ask the sharp, what do you want, and then get to say no. After knowing what side they want, and they can adjust their line. That to me seemed to be the most egregious sort of violation of fair play here in this whole arrangement. But that's what's happening.
That actually is very akin, not that there's a limit, but that's very akin to, you know, what board watchers think of with early money, right? That, you know, the early movement, what years ago, you know, when we didn't have as sophisticated, and we certainly didn't have computer batch betting, but the early money versus the late money, you know, now late money is an avalanche, and I don't want to dive into it right this second, but I do want you to, you know, maybe talk a little bit about your thoughts about how this relates to horseplay. because throughout, as I read the piece and I reread it again this morning, there were so many things that immediately jumped off the page, including that conversation about the fundamentals and the technical, which you know is basically handicapping and then assessing the market. It's very much what we do as horse players. It's got obvious parallels. That whole piece, that portion you did about steam, and you know Spanky's ability to be successful on the steam betting. That's the same as reading the board. I mean, there was so much about this that has got racing parallel, and it also seemed to me that any players of the sharp variety that are being limited, why could we not bring them to the horseplay side? And I am curious how much horseplay came up in any of your discussions, with some of the prominent pro bettors you worked with in this piece.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, like you mentioned Dink before, and he says that he always tells young players that they should, they should look at horse racing because it's a good game it's a good gambling game. It's a place where you can bet a little and win a lot, which is something you can't pull off so much in sports. I do think there is quite a bit of cross-pollination between most, handicappers and the races. But, a guy like Spanky doesn't really play the horses because Spanky, you mentioned that he's what they call a steam chaser before. And for your listeners who may not know, I mean, Spanky's sort of like, he's kind of akin to a day trader. He watches screens and what he tries, he doesn't handicap games. He tries to anticipate where the market is moving based on how the lines are moving and how people are betting. And he has models that will predict which direction the line is going so that he can try to get in on the best side of it. And, some sports players look down on this, I think the idea, the term like steam chaser or steam player is a pejorative among sports gamblers, it seems. And screen scrapers, board cleaners, people kind of look down on them because I think that they are less respected than someone who's a handicapper who, handicaps a game and comes up with their own opinion of what a line should be and then bets it when they think the bookmaker's opinion's off. So Spanky's not somebody who would play horses or really any other sport that his model doesn't really work for. But I think a lot of sports players who are handicappers also look at racing because it's a great game where you have lots of data that you can use to handicap and come up with your own opinion. And also you're not just putting your opinion up against a bookmaker's opinion, you're putting it up against the public. So I do think there's a lot of crossover. The reason that horse racing didn't enter into the story much is that the way that the sort of betting pools work is so different that this kind of issue is unique to the sports book. And I think that, one of the things I learned writing the story was I learned about the exchange model in sports betting where some companies in Europe offer an exchange where essentially all they're doing is allowing people to come up and post up a bet and someone else to come and take that bet. And the exchange sort of just takes a little piece out of the market. But that the exchange is just a place for people on different sides of a game or a proposition to come and find each other and enter into that bet. And that model, it has its flaws too. It's not perfect. But that model avoids a lot of these issues that we're talking about where bookmakers, cut people off or limit people or deny people action so that they can maximize their profit by only booking square money. An exchange may be an answer to that, if we can find enough people who are willing to make markets. And there are people here in the States that I met while I was writing the story, and it just kind of got so big and so long that I decided not to dive into this exchange question. But there are people who really had me, drinking the Kool-Aid a little bit about the idea that an exchange could be the third way here, and could help us help professional sports players find a way to get large numbers, large amounts of money into action. And that's something that's a little bit more in parallel with pari-mutuel betting where, the winners in horse racing are paid with the losers' money. So the track doesn't worry about it coming out of their end,
Right. What sense did you get, Dave, in the conversations with the pros as to what the, you know, what the development of the marketplace is going to be in the United States, and what the, you know, what kind of experience is going to be realized? I mean, because you do sense, and I said this in conversation, you know, the last year when this has been discussed, that it feels to me that racing has an opportunity to lure, even with our odious takeout structure, that we have an opportunity to lure bettors that think they're going to be some big success as sports bettors, and they're going to be in for a shock, and that it's not going to be as easy as they think. Not that horseplay is easy, but that we could advertise that we've got a game where you've got a fighting chance, because you're not, you know, you don't have the house. I mean, the house is taking its share, but you're betting against everybody else. And if you can carve out an opinion that is superior to others, you will win, and you can win exponentially. And I just think we've got a good story to tell.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that, like, as much as we hate the takeout in so many places, and you know, horse players hate the takeout, I think that it still may seem to be an attractive option for sports players, especially because there's going to be takeout as we see more states come on with sports betting. There's going to be more and more takeout there too. I mean, one of the issues that's a real hot button issue in the world of sports gambling right now is that the leagues are pushing for what they call integrity fees. And this is really scummy. This is where the same leagues who opposed this ever happening, right, and argued at the Supreme Court that they should not overturn PESPA, are now insisting that they should get a big chunk of the money. And they're asking states to, as they pass different laws, you know, regulating this stuff, they're asking that states include them, that they should get like a, you know, 1% of the handle or whatever. And so they're not asking for a chunk of revenue. They want a chunk of handle. They want to take out, you know, money, you know, before any of the bets are made. And that's in addition to cuts that go into revenue for, you know, for the state's share of the revenue for taxes. That's, you know, in addition to the cost of running brick and mortar books, which some states are insisting on. You know, there are some states that aren't even doing mobile. They're insisting that all these places be brick and mortar, which I think is kind of stupid. And so, you know, in some states, even their share of revenue is really high. I think that what I heard from a lot of sports players is that they think that this is going to happen across the country, but that states are going to be disappointed with how much they can bring in. I mean, one of the things that I don't think people are talking about enough is that the sports, if you go to Vegas, right, if you go to Nevada, the sports book is the most risky gaming, it's the most risky part of any casino's gaming portfolio, right? It's where they could stand to take the biggest loss. They have about a 4.5%, you know, edge. So they typically look at Nevada, you know, in Nevada, they typically look at sports books as an amenity, right? It's not something that's going to help them with their bottom line. They're willing to even take a loss sometimes with sports book if they have to, because it's an amenity to get gamblers into the casino. It's something to offer gamblers and visitors, but it's never anything that they put front and center. But in some states that are now passing sports gambling, but they don't have other kinds of commercial gaming, this is going to be front and center. We're going to see more and more sort of standalone sports books. And we saw the same thing happen in Europe where, you know, in the UK, where there were all, you know, there's more like William Hill and Betfair, you know, shops there than there are, you know, it's like Starbucks here, you know, it's like they're on every corner. And they were mostly fueled by these kiosks where people could bet on roulette and play other kinds of gaming, you know, casino games on the kiosk in the sports bet shops. And once they did away with those, they started to see all these brick and mortar places close up because there wasn't the same revenue anymore. So having the sports book be your only revenue model, and you're insisting that it, you know, kind of have a lot of overhead with, you know, brick and mortar and stuff, it just doesn't seem like it's going to pay off for them the way that they maybe some of these states are hoping it will. But once they figure out that the real business is mobile and there is a way to make money here, and they figure out how to like work with their customers and they start to learn the business, you know, it'll all even out in the end, but it's going to be kind of rough sailing in the beginning. The good news is that what we see in New Jersey, what gamblers are saying to me about New Jersey, is that when you have a lot of companies that are all trying to corner the market, they just throw these bonuses at you left and right. I mean, I heard at a conference that in New Jersey, these companies are, most of them are saying that it's costing about $1,000 to acquire a new player. That's their kind of marketing cost for acquiring new players. That's ridiculous. Like, there's no way you're going to recoup that. But they're spending that much because each of those companies are hoping that they can kind of corner the market. So there is a bit of a bonanza for players in terms of bonuses and that kind of stuff. And I think that any market that's going to have lots of companies competing, in the short run at least, they're going to see players will see some value there. But that'll all, you know, that won't last forever. I think one day we'll just see that sports betting will be a normal thing in American life, and it'll be something that we do online or on our phones. Maybe we'll do it. You know, some of these arenas are trying to push for having in-play wagering in the arena, like have the technology to do it in the seats or kiosk in the arena. That's a thing that people are looking forward to. But honestly, I think that it's just something we're going to do on our phones, and it'll just become kind of normal. But it's going to be weird getting there. I think the road there is going to look weird. And I think the road for the professional player is also going to be very rocky. The thing about my story and about Spanky and what some of these other players are doing to fight back that's inspiring and interesting to me is that I don't think this, you know, I think the sports players would be wrong to take it on the chin and to say, oh, well, and let this go the way that, you know, blackjack card counting went. I think they're smart to fight back because I think the public will be on their side. And I think that as state legislatures are taking up the question of whether to regulate this stuff at all, it's important to have this be one of the questions that people are thinking about and talking about as we regulate it in more states, because we need to protect the integrity of the game and make sure that players get a fair bet, get an opportunity to make a fair bet, and that we insert some sort of, you know, that we insist on fairness from bookmakers as we create regulations around how they're going to do business in the United States.
Dave Hill with us, and we're talking about his terrific and expansive piece that is titled The Rise and Fall of the Professional Sports Bettor, and or Requiem for a Sports Bettor. Our game on the horseplay side, and when you talk about spending $1,000 to acquire a player, I mean, we're woefully prepared to counter that.
Right. On marketing, on bringing in new players.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, some of that $1,000 goes into ads and stuff. Some of it goes into bonuses and promotions that they're putting up to bring in new players and hoping that these players will open accounts and stay with them. But I've said this in a number of interviews, and I'll say it again now. I think that the dumbest thing that this industry seems to be doing to me, and look, I'm not a marketing expert. I'm not a business expert. You know, I'm just a writer. So, you know, in some ways, I'm just a bit of a jailhouse lawyer when it comes to all this stuff, because I've just spent the last few months kind of, submerging myself into it. But it does seem to me like, if from my point of view as somebody who is a recreational gambler who might want to bet on sports in a state like New Jersey, like the way that some of these companies are marketing their product, I mean, look, what do we see with William Hill? Like, who are the gamblers that they put in front of us to show us that we can win? They show us, like, some sucker that made, like, a 20-team parlay bet and won a big number. And they give him a big, giant check, you know, almost like a lottery winner. And they take their picture and they say, look at this guy. He got so lucky. Look at this person who bet on Tiger Woods or whatever to win the Masters. And I think that's not the right move. I mean, to try to lure people in by saying, like, hey, you could get phenomenally lucky and win a ton of money isn't the way to get someone in who's going to make a number of bets every weekend and really try to handicap games. And those people are not going to get lucky, and they'll just go broke, and they won't be your players anymore. I think they should market the professional bettors. I think they should market the Rufuses and the Spankies and Captain Jacks of the world, because the promise that I could one day maybe be good enough at this that I could quit my job and make a living just watching games and handicapping games, is what will make me want to dig in deeper and play more. And one of the things on that spectrum you mentioned before of the sort of seven different types of bettors is that it is a spectrum. It is a ladder. You, like, move across it. And you may hang out in one zone of that spectrum for a long time. So on my way, on my quest to try to become a professional gambler, you know, I'm going to be a kind of a, you know, I'll play a lot more. And I'll be a better customer for these books over the long run. We're not all going to become sharp players. Very few of us will. So I don't think that it's realistic for them to just fear that we're all going to get so sharp that we'll put them out of business. And also, these people are colorful. I mean, the reason people like my story is because it's about, and it's because it's Spanky's story. It's because his life story is interesting. It's colorful. It's fascinating. It's unique. And I think that people are interested and fascinated by gamblers and people who make their living by taking these kinds of risks and playing games. I think that's very interesting to us. So I think the industry is missing an opportunity to turn their sharp players into celebrities and market them to show us that, hey, if you get as good as these guys, you can make a living at this. Come and play with us. I think that'd be a much better strategy for getting the kind of player who's going to pump a lot of money across the counter and do it in a responsible and thoughtful way than just trying to get square money in by saying, hey, come make a 20-team parlay and see if you get lucky, and just trying to break everybody as quick as you can.
Well, from the motivation of having you come on, and also, you know, when I reached out to Maury as well about the topic, what kind of motivated me was that Scott Berry from St. Louis, who was all over the internet, you know, during the Stanley Cup Finals, for his $400 play in January when the Blues were struggling, and you know he got 250-1, so $100,000 win on the $400, and they're carrying on like like it's some miraculous, and oh my God, it's like whoa, wait a minute, just. Friday, Saturday, Naira had, you know, had the 2-day pick six for 20 cents. It paid $9,500 and it was eminently hittable and approachable. And we get these 7 days a week. Stop with this. Oh, the guy won 100,000. Okay. Yeah. You can do that. You can do that every day in racing. Why? You know, we've got our work to do to tell our story. I kind of rolled my eyes at the whole thing with that $100,000 punch.
No, that's a great point. And it's true that it's so rare that you see those kinds of things in the world of sports betting, because this is like, you know, kind of going back to Dinky's point that I made before, most bets in sports are coin flips. You know, you're betting 11 to 10, you're betting 110 to win 100. You know, there's not these futures and props that pay off big. They're never very big. You know, you never get the kind of odds that you can get in some of the horizontal bets that we do in horse racing. It can be frustrating because in order to really make a lot of money in sports, you got to bet a lot of money. You got to have a much bigger bankroll. And if you want to market a game by saying, hey, come in here and bet a little and hope you get lucky. Well, horse racing is definitely the game to make that case, not the sports book. But they still seem to think that, you know, that still seems to be a big part of how they market sports betting.
Well, I couldn't wait to. I always love getting you on the show, and whatever topic that you. You know, you managed to wander into because you're an easy mark for an intriguing story.
It's interesting that there's a section in the story that's about kind of the history of sports gambling in America, and I do think it was really it was eye opening to me when I realized that the real birth of sports betting and that kind of bookmaking in America came when. When states stopped running the races during the war, and all the horse players didn't have any action, so they went to the ballpark. And the same bookies from the tracks who were, you know, the ones taking bets at the track on horses, they showed up at the baseball parks and started offering bets on each pitch. And that was kind of the birth of sports gambling in America. So if we had never stopped running those horses, maybe we'd have, you know what I mean? Maybe we'd have never seen sports betting take off and horse race, you know, maybe there's this parallel universe where horse racing, you know, just stayed in the forefront of American life. But it is true that, like, horse racing gave birth to all of this. You know, we're the original sportsman's game.
Well, and there's so much in the story that with each, you know, with each nuance that you discuss, you take a historic look, including the origins of the lines of the betting lines and how those, you know, evolved, and the sports book. I mean, from a historic perspective, you know, with a modern and current analysis, it does it all, and does it typically well in Dave Hill fashion. Meanwhile, what's going on with the young Bobby Fischer?
You know, he's taking lessons. He's got a new teacher now. I'm not teaching him anymore. He's gotten good enough that I've had to hand him off to a master to teach him. And the season's over, so we're through the summer. He'll just take lessons, and we'll start up tournaments again next fall. But he's still playing.
Well,
I got two other kids I got to teach chess to. You know, they're all getting old enough now that I got to teach the other two, so that I'll have a whole stable.
I love it. soon, somewhere in Brooklyn or maybe in Prospect Park, you know, you'll have those tables set up, and the kids will be hustling, doing some chess hustle.
Yeah, we'll bring the set to Belmont this Sunday. If any of you dads are out there, you want to come out here and play some chess with the Hills. Come on, find us the playground.
I love it, Dave. Dave is he's basically been living out the whole script of searching for Bobby Fischer, essentially.
It's
what has been going on. It was like, oh my God, the child's a prodigy. I've had a lot of fun following it, Dave. Whatever you write about is always it's always a story well told, and no exception here for The Ringer. What are you working on next?
I've got a couple of secret projects in the work. Maybe a podcast that might come out. I guess I'll just stay tuned. But got a couple irons in the fire.
Excellent.
That I'm not sure I can talk about yet, but
all right,
we'll see.
Well, you know who is happy to publicize it, cannot wait till we'll be giving people instructions to pre-order The Vapors. It looks like that'll come early next year. So, Dave, we going to see you at Saratoga this summer?
You'll see us there, yeah.
Excellent.
We'll be there. I'm not sure. We won't be there the whole month, but we'll be there for maybe a week, and we'll be at Belmont this weekend.
Outstanding. Well, enjoy Father's Day, and well done on this story for The Ringer. I send out the link for everybody, those that haven't gotten to it. It is it's not a classic long read, but it's longer than a short blast, and well worth your time. Dave, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
Not at all. Dave Hill, 77. Follow him on Twitter. He's inquisitive, and he's just gifted as can be. I cannot wait till The Vapors comes out. Dave Hill, whenever he's written for the, particularly for ABR, you know, when it's something equine related, that's what most of you are probably familiar with. But his other things are just amazing. If you haven't seen the piece he did, in fact, he's got it pinned. I just went to his page. He's got the pinned tweet. I talked about that story that started out as a story on cockfighting and morphed into something very different. And Dave just follows wherever the story takes him. And obviously the editors just trust him to deliver, you know, whatever it is that wherever the story goes. And he's just terrific. Let's take a top of the hour timeout, and we'll come back for hour two. We've got Marty McGee We got to dive into the big Saturday night card for the Stephen Foster and the other four stakes. And then got Nick Tamaro to get to. I'm going to have to do some tap dancing here because Ed DeRosa needs to be on before 11 so we can swing hammer past 11. That won't be a problem. And yeah, so Marty and Nick and Ed in this next hour, and then we'll get to Rick and to Nick Luck. There we go. There's your show. Back after this, hour two at the races.